Coal is the single largest source of electricity around the world, making up 37% of all energy usage globally. It's a concern that came up at the UN COP26 climate summit, which ended last week. The UK and European Union pushed for a total phase-out of coal, but growing economies like China and India, who rely on coal, pushed back. Coal power is a big part of the global economy, but it's also a big contributor to climate change. We're taking a look at the new UN climate agreement to decrease the global reliance on coal and what it would take to get there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think slowing down global warming by cutting coal usage would work? Do you worry about the economic fallout of that? Places like Wisconsin use a lot of coal. What do you want to see that replaced with, if you want to see it replaced at all? Do you have questions about the global reliance on coal energy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Thurber is Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. He's the author of the book, Coal, about the history and use of the resource. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you first talk about the role that coal plays in the global economy right now?
Sure. As you just mentioned, coal is on the order of about 36% of global electricity generation. And it's about 25% of total primary energy. So that includes use of coal for industry as well as for making power. So it's very big contributor to the global economy.
And how about climate change? There's a lot of forms of fossil fuel energy. Why the focus on coal as a source of climate change emissions?
Coal is the worst on climate change emissions. So coal is responsible for something almost about 30% of human-caused global greenhouse gas emissions.
There was talk of a phase out of coal in this summit last week, changed to a phase down, or some of the words to that effect. Looking at what came out of there, what do you see in the commitments, the efforts to not eliminate but reduce the efforts of coal? What is the world trying to do according to this summit?
Well, so I think everybody recognizes the outsized impact coal has environmentally. And I think the summit language is a recognition of that. And in some sense, it's probably the best we can hope for out of these kinds of summits is everybody acknowledging they're on the same page and deciding that collectively we want to do something about it. But ultimately, it will be up to individual countries to follow the paths they choose to phasing out coal.
Now, we've seen here in Wisconsin, the WEC Energy Group, a big utility company, biggest in the state, said earlier this month, hey, we're going to phase out coal by 2035, switch over to natural gas. Are we seeing this happen a lot in the U.S. in states that have historically depended, like Wisconsin, on coal for their electricity?
Yes, we're seeing this all over the country. And there are a few reasons for this. Ultimately, what's driving these coal phase outs in the U.S. is economics. Natural gas in the U.S. is cheaper than it is most places around the world. And coal plants in the U.S. are almost entirely, including the ones in Wisconsin, very old. And so it's just reaching the point where it's not as economic to keep these coal plants going. And the U.S. has this luxury of being able to switch over to natural gas, which it's done. If you look at in 2005, about 50% of U.S. electricity came from coal. Now it's closer to 20%.
Now let's talk about countries like China and India. I understand that on a per capita basis, per person in those countries, a lot less climate change emission than per person in, say, the United States. But there's a lot of people, so it adds up to a lot of climate change emission. Can you talk about the role in those two countries of coal in those two countries in particular?
Yes. So it's a very large role. So if you look at China, about 70% of their electricity comes from coal. And then that's in addition to the use of coal in industry. And then in India, it's an even higher percentage of their electricity comes from coal. And it's also used in industry as well. And the challenge those countries have is they don't have the opportunity quite as near at hand as the U.S. did to quickly switch over to some other fuel, because the U.S. already had in place the natural gas infrastructure. And especially when we started producing more natural gas with the shale gas revolution, the conditions were ripe to make a quick switch. And that's much harder in these other countries. And unlike the US, these are countries where the economies are still growing fast, demand is still growing fast, and so it's a much thornier problem.
Talking to Mark Thurber from Stanford University's Program on Energy and Sustainable Development, author of the book Coal, looking at efforts from the recent Global Climate Summit to scale back the use of coal around the world. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I was going to point out two things. One is that as long as other people are paying the bill for recovery efforts after a fire or a flood, all the companies involved in fossil fuels, especially coal, are not actually paying their own bill. So we can't really say that coal is cheaper because coal may be simply letting somebody else pay for some of the things that it is responsible for. And in relation to other countries that use a lot of coal, especially China, we actually could or should put some sort of fee or fine on them for adding pollution to the world stage. And we probably ought to be talking with other people around the world to make this, if nothing else, part of a large trade agreement so that other countries don't get away with pollution that everybody has to suffer through.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. Let's look at that first point first, Mark, the idea of, I think economists call it externalities. For me to buy a bunch of coal and burn it, it's pretty cheap. But Nate's saying if you factor in the costs to health and to pollution and to climate change, it's fairly expensive. How do we sort that out?
I agree 100% with Nate. So as you say, Rob, this is called a negative externality. So it's a social cost of using coal that is not factored in by the parties to the economic transaction. So as you say, a power generator can burn coal, and unless there's some kind of carbon tax in the jurisdiction where they are, they don't have to pay for any of those costs of climate change. And so I'm a strong believer that they should, and I'm a strong believer in carbon pricing. And the second piece of what Nate is talking about is the idea that, let's say that we as the U.S. would put in place some kind of substantial tax on greenhouse gas emissions. And so then what you could do is you could say, well, we're going to make a border tax adjustment of, you know, for things that we're importing from other countries that tries to account for the carbon content that went into those. And so it would be a way in theory of putting pressure on other countries as well to price in carbon. I have to say, as the United States, we're not doing the best job of this yet ourselves of pricing carbon. So that's probably where we want to start. But I certainly agree with the points Nate is making.
Thanks for that call, Nate. If I were a trade negotiator for an India or a China, and I'm not, but if I were, I might say in that case, well, wait a minute, you, United States and Europe have been using coal for a long, long time. Why are you hitting me with, in effect, a coal tariff now after you've been burning this stuff for so long?
Yeah, and you'd be right, too. And that is what those countries say, that really what we shouldn't look at is, you know, you brought up the point of per capita emissions. And that's one important point, that you know, the U.S. per capita emissions are far higher than most other countries around the world. But they would also bring up this point of historical responsibility. So if you look at carbon dioxide in particular, it's a very long-lived greenhouse gas. And so, you know, you really have to think about cumulatively how much have countries emitted over time. And so, you know, ultimately, the challenge is that both sides have a point, right? That developing countries have a very valid point that they should have a right to develop and to grow and lift their people out of poverty. At the same time, we won't be able to solve the climate crisis without some significant actions by growing lower income countries as well. And so this is sort of the dilemma. And I think one answer to that is I think the richer countries need to do a lot more, especially financially, to support growing countries in making different choices that are more environmentally friendly.
Nate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Ivy next in Evansville. Ivy, hello.
Nate. Hi. Another economics fallout from that is damage to our infrastructure from high seawater. But I wanted to bring up what I would like to see is a focus on decentralized energy, because you centralize the energy, it leaves communities more vulnerable to natural disasters, to cyber attacks, to terrorism. And it also, you know, is pot. I mean, it's not going to solve all our energy needs, but we have a lot of rooftops, and there are wind generators that you can put on rooftops that also don't kill birds. They're spiral. And, you know, and as far as natural gas goes, there are also problems with the fracking and the pollution caused by that and the use of fresh water diverted for that purpose.
Ivy, thanks a lot for the call. Mark, Ivy, looking for more decentralized rooftop solar, wind power here and there. I think you wrote a piece saying bigger's better, you think, when it comes to solar or wind.
Right. Well, and so my argument in that piece, so there is a lot of increasingly decentralized use of renewables. Certainly in California, where I am, we have a lot of, you know, there are a lot of incentives for rooftop solar. And, you know, I think that's making a useful contribution. Looking at things in the big picture, the big challenge with renewables and with wind and solar in particular is costs have gone down a lot, which is fantastic, and it's enabling us to put in a lot more wind and solar. The big challenge is that they're not necessarily there when you want them. And so if you look at California, we're putting in more and more solar to achieve very aggressive renewable goals for the state. But it means that, you know, putting in one more solar unit that's going to generate at the same time as all the other solar units during the middle of the day, you're at some point not getting as much additional value. And moreover, you could have a day where it's cloudy and you're not getting any generation at all. And so one advantage of a larger, more interconnected grid is it helps you better balance this intermittency of wind and solar. And so if wind and solar aren't there at one location in time and one location in space, they might be there somewhere else. And so if you have a larger grid, you can get power from where it's being generated to where it's needed, and you start to average out these fluctuations in wind and solar better. Another place that I look at a lot is looking at energy in lower income countries and especially looking at sub-Saharan Africa. And that's a place where, you know, I think there is some important near-term role of decentralized power, especially in the absence of very workable large grids. But even there, you have this challenge that it's a little bit harder to manage this fluctuation of renewables without the benefits of a larger grid.
Thanks for that call, Ivy. We're talking to Mark Thurber about the idea of phasing out, or at least phasing down, coal globally. He's Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University, author of a book called Coal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see coal scaled down here in Wisconsin, around the country, around the world? What are you hoping to see take its place, especially when it comes to producing electricity? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Stanford environment and energy researcher Mark Thurber about the idea of phasing out coal, or at least cutting back on the use of it for climate change reasons, both within the U.S. and around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark, nuclear power. I'm seeing in the news an idea of going to Wyoming, a big coal-producing state, and saying, hey, if we're cutting back on coal, we could do some nuclear development. People make the case, say, hey, this isn't your parents' nuclear energy. It's cheaper, it's safer than you might think it is. What are your thoughts on that as part of the picture in replacing coal's electricity production?
I think nuclear could be a big part of the solution. If you look at the U.S. power mix right now, it's approximately 40% of electricity is coming from natural gas, approximately 20% from coal, 20% from renewables, hydro, wind, and solar, and about 20% from nuclear. And so I think there's a lot of value to expanding that. The big challenge with nuclear has been that it's so expensive to build. And so it's hard to get generating companies to build nuclear because it just seems too commercially risky for them. And one particular challenge with nuclear in the US is as we put in more renewable capacity, it's actually making the nuclear plants less financially viable because nuclear plants, like coal plants for that matter, are very expensive to build in the first place. So you make your costs back over time by running a very high share of the time. And so what's tricky is if you start to get to where you're running, you have wind and solar that are operating a lot, then that's potentially knocking nuclear out of the mix and making it less financially viable. So I'm very supportive of efforts to further develop nuclear, and especially some of these advanced nuclear technologies I think are very promising. But I think there's this financial hurdle that will have to be dealt with.
We heard from Larry in Illinois, who says China uses a lot of coal. We talked about that. And he says Australia sells a lot of coal, and Australia isn't going to stop selling it. And I understand one of the biggest coal ports in the world is, in fact, Australia. Can you talk about Australia's role in negotiations to limit coal use?
Yeah, I mean, Australia is, along with Indonesia, those are the two biggest coal exporters in the world. And yes, I mean, this is an important part of Australia's economy. And so there's a lot of political resistance to stopping exporting it. So I think, that's a challenge in the big picture. And that's a challenge in this country and sort of in all countries. You have this political confrontation between the economic interests that benefit from coal and the folks who are very worried about the environmental impacts of that.
Talking to Mark Thurber, Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. Talking about the future of coal, a commitment to scale back the use of coal globally came out of that big climate change summit last week. Some had been pushing for a phase out of coal. Still time for your thoughts, your questions on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, I sometimes hear kind of a blueprint for the future where we switch from coal to natural gas, as you were talking about earlier, for a while, for the medium term to cut back the climate impact of using fossil fuels. And that's our bridge to getting to something else, alternative energy, nuclear, whatever the future looks like. Do you see that as kind of the viable path forward?
Yes, I do. So if you look at all the rich economies right now that are putting in a lot of renewable energy, including the US, places in Western Europe, the de facto backup for the variability of those renewables in almost all cases is gas-fired generation. And gas-fired generation just works really well for this purpose. It's very flexible to ramp up and down. And then financially, it's the opposite of what I talked about for coal and nuclear, in that gas plants are pretty cheap to build. And so you have this low fixed cost, and it can sort of wait around until renewables aren't there or demand is especially high, and just run less of the time. So I think what one could envision for the transition would be a period where, we move away from using gas as much for just bulk megawatt hours of electricity, and move to using natural gas as providing reliability services. So it's running a lot less, but it's there just for when it's needed for renewables backup. And then I think, further into the future, hopefully, we could move to entirely zero carbon sources.
Let's go to another caller now. Jeremy is with us in Kenosha. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that a lot of this discussion is predicated on the idea that coal is necessarily dirty. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore. I had a friend that used to work at a coal power plant, and he said that it can be very clean. You just need expensive scrubbers in the smokestacks. So I wonder if that's considered, especially when you compare the waste from nuclear, that I don't know how you get rid of that.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Mark, have we cleaned up coal enough to where it's not as big a problem for pollution and or climate change?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So I sort of think about clean coal on two dimensions. And the one that the caller was referring to is cleaning it so it doesn't create local air pollution, you know, doesn't create sulfur oxides, nitrous oxides, things that cause smog, particulates. So that is absolutely, as the caller said, there are technologies to take care of those local pollutants. The thing that's much harder is the CO2 part of it. So the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, and coal is about twice as much CO2 that it emits per electricity you make as natural gas. And so that's much more challenging and expensive to scrub out. There are technologies for doing this. So this is what, when people talk about CCS or CCUS, carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And so there are ways to do that. The reason I'm a little pessimistic that those will be implemented at large scale is the appeal of using coal is that it's cheap. And so if you're adding on things that add a lot of cost to capture the CO2, then coal's not going to be cheap anymore. And so I'm a little bit skeptical of the long-term future of carbon capture from coal. I think if carbon capture does play a role, it's more likely to be carbon capture from natural gas-fired plants, for example.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob. I enjoyed it.
That's Mark Thurber, Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. He's the author of the book, Coal, About the History and Usage of the Resource. He talked to us about efforts to phase out the use of coal in international climate change agreements. Originally, phase out was the idea, then changed to phase down.